Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I'm a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member. And tonight I'm really honored and really excited to be here today with Nora Berger. If you have a topic you're interested in, or you want to be interviewed, or you know someone you want to be interviewed, or you have comments in any of the episodes I've done already, please reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at joma.org. We want to hear from you. So tonight I'm really excited to be interviewing Nora Berger. Nora Berger is a fellow occupational therapy student with my daughter and her good friends. And this is what she says about herself. I am a lot of things in no particular order, a Yonkers native, an occupational therapy student looking to specialize in pediatrics, a dancer, an aviation enthusiast, an automotive rail fan, and an unashamed Pokemon player. My bachelor's degree is pediatric occupational therapy through dance from NYU Gallatin. I had to take supplemental classes at LaGuardia for entry to Touro Occupational Therapy Program. I worked with nonverbal autistic toddlers in Woodhaven and later transferred to ACDS Westchester, working with the same population of children. I use my neurodivergent traits for good, not evil, and have made certain connections with students that might not have otherwise been made. I still have so much to learn before I am a professional anything. So I was really excited to interview Nora, who really uses her neurodivergent superpowers to be an amazing student of occupational therapy, and I am quite confident that she is going to be an awesome, awesome pediatric occupational therapy therapist when she graduates really soon. Welcome, Nora. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I'm really, really excited. And full disclosure, you're my daughter's friend, and that's how I got to meet you.
Aww.
And she's been talking about you for a very long time and raving about you. You're both occupational therapy students. And so I wanted to talk to you about your personal experiences, particularly with sensory stuff, and how they're going to help you become an awesome occupational therapist. And I want to get you started first with your backgrounds. And by background, I mean, you know, your education, you know, experiences you've had that have, you know, built the professional that you're going to be, taking your personal experiences into account.
Yeah. Wow. My professional OT journey on paper, it started on a whim at NYU. I went there for undergrad, and to be completely honest, on Thursdays, it just so happens to be Thursday, but on Thursdays, I had a hole in my schedule that I needed to fill with classes. And so I sort of filtered out the classes I was signing up for. And one of them was Intro to OT. And I didn't even know what OT stood for when I started, but I was like, that sounds good. And so I took a class about OT on a whim, and I was like, okay, this is cool and stuff, but I knew it was what I wanted to do when we visited a place in Lower Manhattan that had children. It was a gym, essentially. It was sensory and strengthening related gym. And this kid comes in and trips over something, falls, but then runs back, gets up and runs again. And the lady who was talking to us said, oh, by the way, so and so, she only started, she only started walking like 6 months ago. And I was just like, wow, that's pretty nifty, you know, that you can go from zero to moving quite quickly. And I was like, you know what, that I think that's what I want to do.
Interesting. So before that, you never thought of OT. What were you studying?
Because I had no idea what I wanted to do, I was at NYU Gallatin, which is the one that no one's heard of, the one that it sort of like make your own major, but with strings attached. And that was where I was. And I didn't occur to me until I was in junior year that, oh my goodness, this is what I want to do. So I sort of, a lot of people in our cohort at Toro, they were like in a program already to start doing OT, the graduate stuff early. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, not for nothing, but when I was a goofy 19-year-old, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And yet there's people coming in, they're 18, 19 years old, and they're like, yep, that's what I want to do. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. And I just had no idea. I'm quite frankly a little jealous, but yeah.
I know everybody, you know, comes to what they're going to do at a different age. Like I was really scary. I knew I wanted to be a pediatrician from the time I was 7 and a doctor from the time I was 3, but that's really weird. You know, most people do figure it out later.
Yeah.
So this isn't unusual, but what appealed to you specifically about occupational therapy?
This is going to sound really cheesy, but that the help that you were providing, that you could see it. You could, it's not like, not to disparage lawyers or anything. Both my parents met at Hofstra, by the way, but law school, but that if you're helping somebody and it's like, okay, somewhere in the long run, they'll benefit. But with OT, it's something where you're building and building and building, and you can see results, especially when you're doing if you're testing and retesting to see what kind of progress has been made with any treatment of anyone. But pediatrics was what I knew was my thing for a long time. But
why pediatrics?
Particularly because I consider myself, well, I was sort of told at the time, my mom always called me a strange ranger.
Thanks, mom.
and a little out to lunch, but those were her terms. But I felt like I was more connected to people who weren't going to so harshly judge me, I guess. And because everybody knows I'm like 4 at heart, you know, like we're walking around and I see half a golf ball and I'm like, hey, cool, look at that. And
okay, now you know why I'm a pediatrician. You don't have to grow up.
Yeah, it always a fresh set. But
adulthood is overrated.
Yeah, and apparently adulting is a verb now. But I don't want to call it Peter Pan or whatever. But that is one thing that I definitely feel like I had very good connection with kids from the time that I was, I'm gonna say 8-ish. I had a neighbor who was little, and even though I was 8, and when you're 8, it's not always cool to be seen with, you know, little kids and stuff. It's not cool till you're in mid adolescence, I think, so I've been told.
We're still on kids, you know, because I'm thinking when you talked about, oh, I saw this child walk. Oh, I think, well, that could be PT, you know, that could be physical therapy. And I'm still curious about why occupational therapy, because that's not the same thing as physical therapy. It's not simply a matter of, okay, I see changes, I help them get better.
Of course not. As I see it, the difference is that PT will help you walk.
Mm-hmm.
OT is you're walking for a purpose.
Mm. There's,
so it's fine and dandy that someone can walk, but if you are, as a child, so if you're walking to pick up a toy or something, then it's more OT related, so that they're walking, but there's it's for a purpose. Does that
it does, and it's also, you know, more globally to help you function in the world,
right?
It's not a specific skill building, it's to help you function, which would look different for different people.
Yeah.
I'm a little surprised that you said to me I didn't know what occupational therapy was until college. You never had occupational therapy as a kid?
Probably would have benefited. That's for sure. But but no. And I especially as I was getting older, when I was younger, this is what I've been told. So, you know, like not primary source anymore, but that I was a little off, but I was not tooting my own horn, but I was smart enough to get to be able to sort of mask that. But then once I got to be like 10, then they were like, okay, there's something else going on here. If she's not relating to people her own age anymore, it felt like I could have probably benefited from some of that. Plus, you know, cutting things towards me instead of away from me was a bit of an issue.
So you never had, the bottom line is you never had occupational therapy. You could have used it. And I'm just wondering, now that you know about occupational therapy, right, I'm wondering how it'll be different for you, having had struggles in that area, even if they weren't, you know, you weren't given therapy for that.
Right.
How are you going to bring those experiences to become a really sensitive OT?
Well, I mean, I'm learning along with everyone else, but one thing is that there are certain things that I just can't really do without it really being a negative shock to the system, like, and so if I see that in a kid or something and they're behaving in a certain way, sorry, my foot fell asleep. I guess I should mention like the mayonnaise thing where,
yeah, let's tell the mayonnaise story.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm ready for that one.
Yeah. So I was working as a floating TA, chief cook and bottle washer kind of person at the school I worked at when they first opened. And so what happened was I was subbing in a classroom and these children, they're mostly nonverbal and they have developmental delays. So trying to communicate to us a certain desire or and undesigned, I don't know if that's a word.
What they don't want. What they don't want.
Right. I just, and so I would see certain things and I would be like, everything these kids do is for a reason. It could be sensory related, could not be, but very often it would go unnoticed to the right observer. And so I had this child who had a sandwich with a chicken patty on it, and I'm watching what this kid's doing. He's going really lightly around the edges of the sandwich, and not taking a big old bite of it. And the teaching assistants that were in the room, they were yelling at him, saying, "If you don't finish that sandwich, you don't get to go outside." And it felt very draconian, but also insensitive in a way.
Right.
Because again, these kids, they always do stuff for a reason. And right. So I'm looking at what he's doing, and I realize that on the edges of the sandwich is the only spot where there isn't mayonnaise on it. And mayonnaise, even the word gives me the willies.
You and my husband. Same.
Right. I can't. And so I see this, and he can't say to the TA or to myself, "Help, I don't like this," or anything like that. So I said to them, I said, "You know, it might be the mayonnaise." And they were like, "What?" And so I managed to wipe most of it off of the chicken itself, and he ate it, and they went outside. And so I felt like, okay, you know, for once I'm using my powers for good, you know, for the good of someone else. And so I using my I don't even say it's in intolerance, but my aversion, there we go, to a certain substance, it helped me to understand what he was going through,
right,
and made it so that he still got to do everything that he wanted to do, and at the same time accomplished the same task that they wanted, just in a way that was suitable for him. I don't want to start off with making assumptions like some people, they'll like take it personally almost, and right. it's like, why is this kid misbehaving for me? And like, you know, I mean, contrary to your belief, you know, you're not the center of the universe, and the kids are not doing stuff to annoy you, or
right.
I mean, that sometimes that's just an added plus, but
and sometimes they are, okay.
Yes, but under duress, like to use another legal term, under duress, it usually not to gain negative attention or something. And I think a lot of people, they look at certain behaviors and assume that the kid knows exactly what he or she's doing, why they're doing it, and that it must have some nefarious intent behind it. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I don't like to think of it that way for several reasons, but one of them is that in my experience, I'm just talking my experience, more likely than not, there's a practical reason behind it. And I always say that everything these kids do is for a reason, we might not be able to identify what that reason is. We can only make our best guess based on what we are seeing.
Right. And we should be curious.
Oh, absolutely.
The hot word now is curious.
Yes. No, I'm not saying we, you know, all huddle in a corner and assume that we are unworthy and unable to help these kids. Some of it is trial and error. I mean, it was sort of out of left field that the kid didn't like mayonnaise. They asked me, they were like, how'd you know? I was like, because mayo's gross. And, like, and so it's stuff like that. I've had a couple of experiences that were similar to that I got to enjoy when I was at the school, and there was a lot less pressure, I think, to figure certain things out, because we weren't really expected to be able to. That this was just an added bonus to the many services that I was that I provide. I mean, that was almost like a playground for me to understand more about what these kids needed, and to try to understand what the purpose of what they were doing is. Mm-hmm. So what we often find is that, I mean, a lot of little kids don't like wearing shoes and socks to begin with, but mm-hmm. there were kids who they needed their feet to just go wild and they'd like drag them across the rug and then onto the floor tile. I call it tiles, but it's probably comes in a roll of some sort. And just that was one of the, and it was very, I'm not gonna lie, it was very frustrating, especially when we had fire drills. But it's not, oh, I'm gonna tear my shoes off so that it's annoying for you. And I need to feel this the way that I need to feel this so that I can make myself feel better. It's almost like self-soothing, really.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of the word grounded.
That too is mm-hmm. literally.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. No. But yeah, so there's a, and I'm definitely not part of that camp, but I'm sort of the opposite. Like I do not do the whole barefoot or people foot thing. I even from the time I was little, always wearing socks. Like, and some of that could also come from not getting blisters from ballet shoes and tap shoes and stuff. That might have had a little to do with it. I don't know, but
being a dancer and all that.
Right. It was. But for some of these kids, that's what they need. That's what they crave. Let's find a way to make it functional and get to it.
So how do you do that?
Well, one thing that I would first say is, this is how I feel in general, is I like to see what kind of social history the child has, because when I have that at my disposal, then it really helps to gain their trust and stuff, so that they're more willing to show you what they want. Like mm-hmm. For example, today I have a child who really, really enjoys brushing on her forearms. And what she'll do, she can't speak, but what she'll do is she'll grab your arm and start like squeezing kind of to try to say like, hey, can I have some of that? And I mean, it takes a little while, but meaning for her to figure out that's the best way that I'm going to convey this message to you. I've gotten messages in sometimes better ways than sometimes a little more painful than others, but.
I mean, like a child's pinching you really for the same reason. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes.
I mean, like a child who needs input, they need sensory input and they're pinching and you're thinking, oh, they're bad. Stop pinching.
Well, I'm not thinking that, but there's.
No, I don't mean you. Yeah. I meant the generic you.
Right. That some people's logic goes straight to that. And I feel like if you're going to go straight to that, then you're either having a bad day or maybe you should quit your day job. But
I think you do have a greater sensitivity to this. Not everybody does. Not everybody can see beneath the surface of the behavior.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not a huge fan of going on a purely behavioralist model, because again, like I said, you're making all kinds of assumptions and applying intent when only really the only person who will ever know for sure what the intent is the child.
Right. I'm going to stop for just a minute because I want to not unfairly demean what you apply behavioral analysis. I know you're not saying that, but I just want to be, because there is a controversy about ABA. And a lot of people who identify as autistic are anti-ABA. They're the anti side. And then, of course, there's plenty of ABA providers. And that's the main service used for kids with autism. So it's a hugely important controversy that I want to address just for a second. And I want to say that I am going to be interviewing an applied behavior analyst who will tell us how it can be done right. What you're really talking about is an abuse of it, because ABA, you're supposed to start with what's the antecedent, what happened before the behavior, and be curious about that. But it's easy to just skip to what's the behavior, let's stop it.
Right. I don't have any grudge or
right.
Against ABA. For some kids, it is very it's effective.
Right.
That's not at all what I was trying to
right. do. Right. And I also want to make sure it's very clear to our listeners that ABA is in the hands of the person using it. It's just a tool. It's just a tool. So you're talking about misuse of behavioral techniques, whatever name you want to give it. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah. Okay. Couldn't have said it better myself. I just find that sometimes modifications just they need to be made, even if it's temporary. And I know that ABA, they kind of want you to do things a certain way. And to quote Jerry Seinfeld, not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's nothing against ABA. We had an interdisciplinary thing at school that one of the members of each of our groups, one of them was in school to become BCBAs. Mm-hmm. And so we had some direct interaction with them, and they brought plenty to the table that mm-hmm. at that I the virtual table that I didn't know, and I would like to think that the same thing happened vice versa. there's just no one way to do things, and what works for one person might really not work for somebody else. And yeah, there's no cookie cutters here.
No one size fits all. But back to what you were saying before, is I think you were saying, I don't like it when they just try to quash the behavior.
Right.
Looking at what's behind it.
Right. Because then whatever's going on, it kind of goes unresolved. And then sometimes what happens is, especially when kids have trouble communicating, they get frustrated, and as do the people around them. And that's why go through all that when it can be avoided by doing things to move the relationship to be positive and to see results without forcing anything in particular.
Do you have other stories you want to tell from your training? And again, we're being quite clear that, you know, you're not yet an OT, although you're really close.
the footnote. I worked with a child who, this was in a classroom, an 812 class, 8 children, 1 teacher, 2 TAs, although there were 3 in there because one of the TAs was actually functioning as a 1-to-1. Mm-hmm. For a variety of reasons, a kid might need a 1-to-1. And what would happen is that in that room, even if the 1-to-1 was there, and we'd get there in the morning and be like, okay, so-and-so is some staff member for that room is out. And they'd be like, who wants to be this kid's 1-to-1? Not me. Everybody touches their nose. And I'm like, well, okay. You know, I don't know that much about this child, but only being told, one of the things that I was told is that they know that she's visually impaired, but they didn't know to what extent. Mm-hmm. And so I'm now working with this kid who I didn't really know very much about. And in order to try to determine how impaired she was visually, the only thing I had at my disposal to do that really was with bubbles. Because I have to say that in my experience, kids, when they see bubbles, they want to reach for them. They want to pop them. They want to point as if to say, hey, look at this, you know? And so I wanted to know whether she was seeing lights and shadows, or because despite the scripts before my eyes, I would not consider myself to be visually impaired. So I wanted to understand for myself what was going on. For myself, so that I could help her. And so when I realized that she wasn't reaching for them, and then I looked at her eyes to see if she's visually tracking them, because even if she doesn't reach for it, if she's visually tracking it, I have that to work with. She was not. So I realized, okay, we're gonna have to play some games a little differently. And one of the things that I did with her was, you know, those cubes with the color shapes, you fit them in and stuff. And for children who can't see very well, or for anybody who can't see very well, it's rather difficult to do. I mean, a lot of things are difficult to do, and that's one of them. So what I did with her, after I realized got a rough estimate as to her impairment, I would, I got the shapes for it, and you know, they were not just your regular shapes. They had texture to them and stuff. And so what I would do is I'd rub it on her hand and feel all the different faces of the shape. And I'd say, you know, triangle, square and stuff. And I would guide her hand over the top of the box. And when it would get to the right hole and it would go in, and then, you know, I'd make a big fanfare. Yay! And she just was so happy that somebody was doing something with her that wasn't, it was a positive thing. And she didn't have any, she didn't speak either. Mm-hmm. But what I finally got out of her actually was her, after like the third time that we got the shape in, and she started saying gulgu, gulgu. And I was like, okay, hold on. This kid's definitely trying to say something. And only later did I realize that it was that when her grandfather, when he would come to pick her up, sometimes he'd say, good girl.
Oh,
I realized that's what she was saying. And so when I worked with her again, and I was like, good. And when she'd be like, good, good, good. I was like, that's right. Good girl. And she actually turned to face me.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
That was one of the most treasured experiences that I have is her essentially saying like, this person gets me, at least for right now. But
wow, no, that is so beautiful. Can I tell you what I love about that? I love a lot of things.
Okay.
I love that the first thing you did was, well, we don't really know how much she can see because she's nonverbal, and maybe nobody did anything motivational enough.
Right.
So you pulled out the bubbles and said, I'll know more if she doesn't reach for the bubbles. Right. And I think that just underscores how it's so important to actually work with a child with what they care about.
Yeah. Their currency.
Right. And not just assume that you know something or just give up because they're not responding.
Right.
So that was one thing that I love. And then the next part was, of course, when you said, okay, well, vision is not where we're going to work.
Right.
Because I can tell now I can tell how visually impaired she is. Right. And then you said, let's use all the other senses and let's make it a positive experience.
Right.
And then the third part that I love, because this is a great story. I'm really digging into the story here. And the third part that I love is that when she made a sound, you didn't assume it was random.
Well, yeah, especially when it's the same thing over and over, and it did not appear to it did not appear to be like some kids that their stimming will be like making certain noise through like their nasal cavity. I think that's like a different kind of a sensory stim that I have only encountered once. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't that kind of thing. It was like it was more pragmatic. It was, you know, really trying to communicate.
Right. I mean, I think that is like the essence of OT in one story.
Oh, well.
Okay.
I'll take it.
It's all about function, right? It's all about improving function in the world, you know, pulling on your strengths, right? And bypassing weaknesses that you can't change
right.
in a positive way, in a way that motivates the child. I love it.
Yeah, especially because other staff in the room were not too crazy about if I were to start doing something with a musical instrument. So
bother everybody else with noise.
right. I mean, you know, one person noise is anyway. So yeah, once I realized, okay, you know, we're not gonna work with this sense right now. Let's see what we can do that won't especially take attention with the other kids, they would pay attention to what they need to pay attention to, and not be and not be distracted by the child that I was working with the Rainmaker, which is a fabulous toy in itself, by the way.
Right, I have one.
Yeah, but yeah, it was the best. It was the best way that I saw fit to work with her. The other thing is that, and this is true amongst a lot of staff, no matter what educational level, is very often they will sit, the staff will sit in a chair, but it won't, they're not like down and in the trenches with them. When I was doing this shape thing, I was sitting on the floor, and she was sitting within my legs. So we were both on the same even keel, you know, mm-hmm. like it's not somebody who's barking orders from, you know, 5.5 feet above them. It was being at their level. And I know that even today, I was sort of told like, why are you on your knees? Just get in a chair. And it's sort of like, well, I want to demonstrate how to do this activity. And I want to be closer at their eye level, because even if they're not looking at me, I feel like there's no one's above somebody else figuratively. Right. And that's something that even the lowest functioning kids that I work with, I think somewhere deep down, they recognize that this person is at my level. They're not looking down at me. They're not saying, you know, they're not saying clean this up or something. It's more like, okay, squigs are finished. Put in, you know,
right.
So it's a different, it's the way that I prefer to deal with the kids and treatment and stuff. And I think not that one method is necessarily better than the other, but I find that I'm more successful in helping the kids be more successful if I'm at the same level as them. And that was part of why I was not seated in a chair and had her seated in a chair next to me or across from me or something. It's like that there's, it's not like a straight match. Whereas if I'm all the way down with them, then I feel like it's more effective. And I'm somebody who has terrible, terrible ability to read body language and facial expression and stuff. That's one of my biggest problems. And so I feel like if I am at their level, then some of that pressure is off, because I'm not worried about doing things the wrong way that will possibly be discouraging, or at least make them feel like they are being forced to do things, because nobody likes to be forced to do anything.
Right. Right. I mean, I hear this coming out of you, that you can relate, right, to having struggles, and you don't want to be fixed. You're not broken.
Yeah. That,
right.
As far as I know, I whatever warranty there is probably expired on me, but I wouldn't consider that. It's not right or wrong or better or worse. It's different.
Exactly. And that's why I will use when I go back to introduce you later, the term neurodivergent, which is right. Really just a different way of thinking. Your brain works in a somewhat different way, but it's not bad. It's different. And so I think what you're saying is not really a technique, it's an attitude.
Attitude can be, it can, is a little thing that can change a whole lot.
Right, right. And I'm sure that the kids pick up on it.
Yes. There's that is definitely something that that I even if I'm having like the worst possible day, you know, get being told that, you know, this or that didn't work, or don't do that again, and then I feel like kind of crummy, as opposed to where if it's like, okay, well, that was really terrible, but these kids are still here, they still have a lot of needs, many of which are not obvious to people, and I'm not trying to say you know, I'm like, you know, the whisperer or anything, but
I think someday you will be, but okay. I'm so impressed by what you're doing as a student.
Well, at that point, I wasn't even doing grad school.
Right.
I wasn't even applying to any OT programs at that time.
How much more so then?
Yeah, I think I'm doing the right thing. In retrospect, it'll be, what I'm doing, I'll still be able to say, yeah, you know what? I did that and I'm proud, you know?
Yeah. No, I really think that you're going to be amazing. And I'm really grateful for you for doing this interview with me. I really am.
I know that. I feel like I am getting to do something very special. And if it helps one person, then it's already worth it.
But you already have done that. Even from the few stories you shared,
yeah,
that you've helped people. And yeah. So you're going to take your training and your sensitivity and you're going to integrate them, right? That word again, to be an awesome occupational therapist. And I'm really excited. I want to do part two with you when you're officially an OT.
Okay. And then we'll play this back and then I'll be all embarrassed.
But seriously, I want to thank you so much for doing this with me.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.